Welcome to another Murder, Inc. podcast, and I'm your host, Deadbug, your concierge to the abyss, if you will. And this is the sort of podcast that you'd find over on Patreon. What Patreon is a subscription-based service that for as low as $1 a month, you sign up, you get a weekly podcast, early releases, exclusive content, including my film Columbine, which was removed from YouTube. You also get a growing community that includes some tasty ladies and dudes, if you're into that sort of thing. Me, not so much. I'll leave a link in the description. You can go over and check it out. As low as $1. And all the podcasts you can download as MP3s right to your phone. Now let's get down to business. What drives someone to commit murder? The most heinous of crimes, to take away all that a person has and all that they're ever gonna have. The ultimate of silences. Unfortunately, there's not always an obvious answer. We can study murderers, see what they did, try to understand their life, their childhood, their experiences. We can hope that it'll lead as to a greater understanding of why a person might kill. But we still can't stop it from happening. When an individual's death clock starts ticking, they're already one step into the abyss. On this episode of Murder, Inc., I will be looking at the double murder of funeral home director Dan O'Connell and his student intern, James Ellison. This episode is called An Untimely Death and a funeral home. Hudson is a city in St. Croix County, Wisconsin, U.S. With a population of about 12,000, I guess you could say it's more of a village. And I guess if there's one thing you can say about Hudson, St. Croix, is that everybody in the town will greet you with a welcoming smile. And that a fresh pot of coffee is always brewing in the mayor's office if you want to pop in and chat and voice a concern. A goddamn regular Andy Griffith of the show. It was on a freezing cold afternoon, February 5th, 2002. The type of cold where you walk around with your hands down your pants because your ball sack is as inviting as your grandparents' fireplace. Where the only thing you can't do is roast marshmallows on it. Well, I guess you could, but no one's gonna want to eat them. It was around 1:40 p.m. when local police received a phone call from Marty Shanklin, a fat, balding man in his mid-30s who works for the St. Croix County Medical Examiner, who seems to sweat no matter how cold it is, and prefers bear crawlers that he buys by the dozen from Julie's Donut Joint to any piece of tail he's ever had or dreamt of having. Shanklin had stopped off at O'Connell's funeral home at 520 11th Street. He'd usually pop by once a week, have a couple of cups of coffee, shoot the shit, and gossip about who died that week in their little town, and collect the routine signatures on their death certificates that he'd brought with him. But what Shanklin stumbled across would cause what some would consider inconceivable. Shanklin would lose his appetite for his beloved bear crawlers. Because when he walked into the office to see his old amigo, Dan O'Connell, the only person who knew that while attending Martin Campbell's stag do, that he got so drunk that he'd shit his pants. Well, when he walked into that office, lying dead on the floor with a bullet in his forehead, was Dan O'Connell. And lying beside him with a bullet hole to match was his intern, James Ellison. Which made Shanklin shit his pants for the second time in his adult life. And fearing that he may be next, he dropped his briefcase and bag of bear crawlers and ran out of the office to the nearest phone booth and phoned the police. took police 10 minutes to arrive, but 30 minutes before they'd enter the building. After all, this is small town cops, and they were scared shitless. Most they ever had to contend with was an occasional drunk on a Friday night and shoplifters at the local supermarket. This was a big city crime. Two men killed, execution style, with a bullet to the head. It doesn't get any bigger than that. And when cops finally entered the building, they confirmed the two adult males had been killed, execution style, with a gunshot to the head. There'd been no struggle, and it certainly didn't seem to be a robbery. After all, funeral homes weren't known to handle cash. And as for any witnesses, it was a goddamn funeral home. Yeah, sure, there were people laying around, but they weren't in the position to be telling tales. So cops called the meat wagon, cleaned up the brains, and withheld the names until the next of kin could be notified. Orlando's. It was that evening that the police released the names of the two victims to the public. Dan O'Connell was 39 years old when he died. He was a 1981 graduate of Hudson High School, born and bred. He was active in numerous community organizations. Hell, he even helped raise money for the firefighters after 9/11. He was a regular goddamn Boy Scout. Intern James Ellison, on the other hand, was 22 years old, was pursuing a degree in mortuary science at the University of Minnesota. He'd also attended the same high school as Dan. And by all accounts, both of them were as clean as a sole on a cripple's boot and didn't have an enemy in the world. But Hudson detectives knew that nobody knows nobody that well, and everybody's got a secret. Was it some sort of sick fuck fag thing? Two lovers quarrel, joint suicide? Didn't appear to be, but something didn't smell right. And it certainly wasn't the shit squirts that Shanklin had left on the floor, leading out of the building after discovering the bodies, running to call the cops. Dan's brother Mike, who also worked in the family-run funeral home, was one of the first to have heard the commotion and brought the family priest. He was devastated when he found out that his older brother had been murdered and had no idea who would want to do such a thing. Dan's parents were in Florida visiting a relative when they received the phone call that their son and another employee had been murdered. They too found it inconceivable that someone would want to hurt their son. The family, being deeply religious, only mixed within a social circle that all attended the church. They canceled their trip immediately to drive back home. Daniel O'Connell's funeral was held on the 9th of February at St. Patrick's Church. And to this day, it is still considered the largest funeral ever held in Hudson, with 1,300 mourners attending the service. The service was presided over by Father Ryan Erickson, who read one of Dan's favorite passages from the Bible. And he consoled the O'Connell family the best he could, but they were devastated. Their faith was shaken. They wanted answers. How could someone so good, so caring, meet such a brutal end? The people of Hudson needed to know what happened to Dan and James. But investigators had very few clues to go on. They knew that the two men were both shot close range, execution style. The weapon was a 9mm handgun. Whoever pulled the trigger knew the way around the weapon. Dan was shot once in the head, and James twice. Was it a love triangle? Both men appeared to be straight, with Dan happily married. But who can say? But it definitely seemed like a hit by a marksman who had no problem with making things messy. Investigators interviewed over 2,000 people about the murder, but seemed no closer to figuring out who had done it. At this point, they figured it was a robbery gone wrong. Although there was nothing missing, maybe it was drug users who broke into the building to get embalming fluid to boost their high. When they were spotted by Dan, who knew everybody in the town, they panicked, and then they capped him and his young intern. Although all this, in broad daylight, on a main street, it didn't make sense. Investigators knew it, whatever direction that the investigators tried to throw it in, it kept coming back like a boomerang. A homo boomerang. A relationship gone bad. A love triangle. Who knows, maybe even some homo love club involving stiffs. You can never tell. And maybe the investigators weren't far off. But then, an interesting bit of information came to the investigators' attention. A cult that was named Rest of Jesus, that operated out of the nearby township of Augusta, had sent out over 400 letters to funeral homes. The cult was against embalming and threatened any funeral home that took part in it. The profiteers of death would pay the ultimate price. Now the cops had their first solid lead. But when they investigated who wrote the letters and tracked them down, they found out that each of them had a solid alibi. And in the end, they were all cleaner than the sole on a cripple's boot. A mile of cock and no balls, closing down the only real lead investigators had. They then turned their attention to Dan and James's family. Was there any reason for them to knock off their kin? An insurance policy? Revenge? But in the end, nothing. And the detectives had to concede that they'd got as far as they were gonna get, and that in less than 20 years someone got a bad bout of the conscience, the case were probably gonna remain unsolved. Now admitting defeat, the hillbilly cops let down their pride and got in touch with the FBI, telling them the only witness they had was a woman who saw a man in a white baseball hat and a shirt leaving the funeral home between 12:30 and 1:30 p.m. Based on the information from the witness, the FBI were able to put together a photo fit, but no one in Hudson recognized the person of interest, and they were back to square one. They also put up a $100,000 reward for any information if someone had come forward with any leads. But 6 months afterwards, they still had nothing. Not even a phone call. They even had some of their agents hang out undercover at the local gay bar to see if any freaks got their rocks off from putting holes in funeral directors and their interns' heads. And although a few of the agents ended up getting blowjobs and finding their true selves, they were no closer to solving the crime. And it was at this stage, with only a few scraps of information, the case went colder than the stiffs who watched Dan and his boy take a bullet. Talk to anybody in Hudson, and they'll tell you, at the time of the double murders, their faith was challenged. And why not, if two of the town's most beloved characters could get whacked? There's not much hope for any of them, no matter how much church you go to. After all, I guess many people believe that if you follow all of God's rules, even the ones that contradict each other, you won't end up with a bullet in your head. And one of those people that expected you to follow all of God's rules were Father Ryan Erickson. And although relatively young, he was only 27, I guess you could say he were a fire and brimstone preacher who was against homos, against premarital sex, pretty well didn't like anything that was fun. Although I'm not saying being a homo was fun, although I'm sure it is for some people. Anyways, you get my drift. He was a real life of the party. And although he'd only moved to the town 3 years earlier and had started preaching at St. Patrick's Church, he was well liked and accepted within the community. And he certainly let his presence in the church be known, taking to performing half the service in Latin. And he would regularly name and shame the teenage girls who showed up at his service dressed what he deemed as too slutty, proclaiming them as the devil's temptresses, which raised more than a few eyebrows. But in the traditional quarters, many felt that he was doing God's bidding within the remits of a society that had gone out of control, and that he was the kick up the ass that the church needed. Witnesses say that he would become so passionate during his sermons that he would often cry. Sorry, that was inappropriate of me. As the youth pastor, he also taught sex education at St. Patrick's School. And instead of just a basic introduction to sex, he went all hardcore. Everything to do with sex was a mortal sin. Even thinking about it meant that you could be damned for eternity. Preached about masturbation, abortion, and told the teens that they must confess all their impure thoughts to him and him alone. Because he was a man of God, he was the only one who could absolve them of their sins. Many of the teens weren't too keen on visiting the father, but he insisted on hearing their filthy thoughts. After 2 years, the case went colder than the lifeless chicken-textured legs on a paraplegic. And the O'Connell and the Ellison families had to face the facts that the murder of their loved ones may never be solved. But it was in April of 2004 that Detective Jeff Knobbs and Sean Petty were assigned to the cold case. And the first task was to re-interview several people they thought would be important to the investigation, including an officer who had been in an argument with the funeral home, feeling he'd been overcharged for the burial of his mother. Yeah, sure, it was a long shot, but isn't everything a long shot until it becomes the shot? But either way, the former cop had an alibi tighter than the Velcro straps on a cripple's boot. So the investigators were back to where they started. But it was exactly 3 weeks later that the two investigators were in the office, cooling their heels, watching the ball game, when someone would walk in and blow the case wide open. This has been part one of an untimely death in a funeral home, a Murder, Inc. podcast. And I've been your host, or doorman to the abyss, if you will, to this evening's proceedings. And I'll be returning in the not-so-distant future with part two and the conclusion. And until then, keep your doors locked, your loved ones close, and your finger on the trigger. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, go on over and sign up to Patreon. For as low as a buck, you get a weekly podcast, early releases, exclusive content, and a growing community where you can talk on the forum, do whatever you want, all free of the filthy trolls that exist on YouTube. And as mentioned earlier, there's a tasty community over there. The link is in the description. Go sign up if that sort of thing interests you. This is Deadbug saying adios.
Legion forever!